It was Corey who suggested that we would benefit from looking briefly, perhaps, at the work of Andrew Coyle, who some of you may remember said at a plenary session last year at the APHA that you could divide the globe, the world, into five groups according to the number of people they imprison. I would just like to look at imprisonment rates and see if we can draw some conclusions from that. Imprisonment rates are usually referred to as so many per 100,000. The global average is 140. The average in Europe is 90. We have heard from previous speakers about the high rate in America. It works. Andrew Coyle, most of what I'm going to say is based on Coyle's work and the work of his department. He starts off with a group one, many of the developing countries, and the point he makes here is that there doesn't seem to be an indigenous concept of imprisonment. There seems to be a feeling that to take relatively fit young men, lock them away when they should be out working for the benefit of the community as well as for themselves and their families, is a rather silly idea. India is an example and has an imprisonment rate of 30. Unfortunately, the vast majority of these are just awaiting trial. And also the poverty of the country means that the conditions that they are held in is really very poor. The second group, and he refers to some of the countries of South America, is where there's a complete breakdown in good order. Prisons in with the prisoners in control. Staff will go in to prisons only in groups and only if well armed. There is a feeling, though, that even in those countries, the present position is unacceptable and that change has to be introduced. And much of what I'll be saying in these generalizations that I will be giving, I should stress that the position is changing quite noticeably in some countries. Group three, as a best example is the Soviet Union, where prisons for a while were used for a wide range of purposes, including the retention of people on political grounds. In fact, Russia had a higher rate than the United States, but there was a political decision in Russia just a few years ago that they would reduce the prison population. They reduced the prison population by over 20,000, and their current rate, although it's high, of about 600 per 100,000, is certainly a lot better than it was. Russia has also taken the line that prison reform on its own is not really effective, and what is necessary is reform of the whole criminal justice system. And indeed, we've seen that the changes introduced in some of the newly independent states in Europe, described by one of our members as moving from a camp approach to prison to a cell approach to prisons. In group four, these are mostly the countries in Western Europe as an example. Imprisonment is regarded as the last resort. The range in Europe was shown by Lars earlier on, and in fact it comes from about 40 to 90 is the range. England, I'm afraid, is the, I think John may have mentioned this figure, is leading Western Europe. I don't know if we're proud of this, but we're leading Europe with a figure of over 140 per 100,000. And we could just perhaps, in fact, I'll touch on that later. Group 5 is, according to this particular work, where prisons can be used as much to deal with social problems as with crime. Now, I don't need to talk any more about that, having followed Corrie's paper. The example quoted here is the United States. I think it must be clear from these figures that imprisonment rates can be a matter of political and public choice. What has happened in England, and John can correct me, is that England was perhaps too close to America, and it took over from you some of your very nice ideas, like three strikes and you're out. And we still use that phrase, although I presume it's a baseball term. We in England, we should really say three strikes and you're in. But anyway, these political messages that we have borrowed from you, adopted from you, war on crime, war on drugs, I mean, these have led, I think, to the very high rates in England. Change came, as John has already mentioned, when people began to think about whether prisoners were prisoners first and only, or whether they were patients. And this has led to very useful changes in the healthcare side. I think in the imprisonment rate side, we are still awaiting changes. I think, you might argue, I think I can agree with Coyle when he says that imprisonment rates rarely have anything to do with levels of crime. Another phrase we borrowed, I think, from some of your politicians, and certainly our Secretary of State in charge was very keen on this, and that was prison works. And of course, it certainly doesn't work in terms of reducing crime. It certainly doesn't work in terms of the sort of benefits which society should expect from its public service, its prison service. Someone has said that prisons are a costly and ineffective way of dealing with crime. And so, didn't work. Society has the choice of creating a greater or lesser dependency on criminal and penal processes, and the debate really should be what sort of society do we want to live in. Now, I think I have time to read. I'm grateful to the Women's Health Issues Journal, July-August issue, where the an article by Harold Pollock drew my attention to the opening words of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. The founders of a new colony, whatever utopia of human virtue they had originally in mind, have invariably recognized that among their earliest practical necessities was to allocate to allot a portion of their virgin soil for a cemetery and for a prison. And he goes on to say that Hawthorne recognized that a nation's social arrangements, its fears, its values, can be reflected by those people it puts behind bars. In other words, social values of a nation are reflected by those who are committed for particular crimes, the conditions in which they are kept, and what happens to them on a discharge. So the debate should be what kind of society do we want to live in. And I would suggest that this is really the debate that public health has, isn't it? Whatever our approach to public health, whether it's essentially an ecological one or whatever, we are trying to decide on the sort of society which will ensure the best of health for the majority or for all. It's interesting that in Europe at the moment, they are moving from the Ottawa's concept of healthy policies into health in all policies. And that should be, I think, health also in the criminal justice system. Again, at one of the meetings yesterday, the General Public Health session, someone quoted Margaret Mead, something along the lines, "It should not be forgotten that a small handful of dedicated people can, in fact, change the world." And in fact, that is how change has occurred. I think that it would be great if we could get APHA, already as we are in public health, committed to the social determinants of health, to become equally committed to tackling the social and political determinants of prison, of imprisonment. I think we have in this room the handful of committed and dedicated people, perhaps to create some of the waves that John was talking about, but to make a difference in terms of getting our prisons into the sort of public service that we want them to provide, and not a receptacle at the moment for all sorts of people society doesn't want. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the speakers being on time so that we have the opportunity for the discussion that we wanted. Please feel free to give your opinions as well as ask these esteemed panel members any questions you have, and Paul Hayton will come up and initiate the discussion. As I say, Paul works with these characters and is like the man behind the folks who have all those titles, and so he really does all the work, and he's going to do it again. Thanks, Paul.
Well, thank you, Corey, for sussing that out and commenting on it. Yeah, it's been a really fascinating, insightful, and high-quality presentations from our colleagues here. In fact, I didn't expect us to go back 60 years in British history at one point. That was very good. And also to get quotes about Nixon and Barry Goldwater. That was excellent. And Lars, I have to tell you, when you were in the middle of Kyrgyzstan, the lady down here at the front of myself was surprised that a mouse was so interested it came dashing out into the middle of the floor, looked at the screen before being overcome by shyness and going back again. I hope that doesn't put you off eating here later. The question posed, must prisons remain a danger to public health? Before we take questions, I'll just make a few comments and then we'll get going. I think we've seen in John's presentation how with the right sort of political wind blowing in your favour, you can move prison health closer to the centre of public health debate, and you can dramatically increase the funding and do some really worthwhile initiatives in a hopeful way. Similarly, the project in Europe that Lars talked about, 10 years of trying to get best practice and share those examples and come up with standards that people can work to, and that's been encouraging. We've also seen some less than encouraging examples that lead to the short answer, well, yes, it does seem that prisons must be maintained as a danger to the public health. As long as the disenfranchised in society are going to be warehoused in this fashion, it seems that with overcrowding and so on, it seems like an inevitability. But in a group like this, it seems like to me that any right-minded public health professionals are going to say that we really cannot solve big issues in society like TB, bloodborne viruses, without attending to our prison populations. We can't tackle issues like mental health in society unless we also tackle that effectively within prison. We would be unwise to use terms like tackling health inequalities if we weren't also willing to address the people who are imprisoned. So I think in the end, it does come down to the political issue, whether prisons must remain a danger. And that's politics with a large P, whether it's Republican, Democrat, or at home, Conservative Party and Labour. But it's also the small P. I mean, what about the politics within our own organisations? How high up the agenda does this come? Is it a subject that you find some of your professional colleagues would rather back away from? That's maybe an issue too. So it's my job to just invite you to address questions. I think the way it goes is you say the question, I try and make sure that it's out there by repeating it, and then we'll place it with somebody in the panel to start off. Are there questions out there? The lady over here was first. That's a comment, and I think I don't want to repeat all of that. Does anybody want to comment back? Yeah. Alex, could I start with you, or is that... No? I'll come along to yourself. Yeah.
I think that there are very few places where the public health services have intersected with the prison populations. They really have been sequestered from public health, and where they are served by the public health system. For example, in San Francisco, we have a pretty interesting jail medical service, and prisoner patients become part of the universal lifetime clinical record of the city, and if they're referred to clinics within the public health department. And so that having that service as part of the public health service rather than as a jail service is one thing. And I think that traditionally in the U.S. We've had a separation so that the prison has their health service and the county jail has its health service, and there's complete disconnect. And there is a disconnect in the mind of the practitioners and the administrators. And I will use this opportunity to give a 2-minute example of this crazy thing that's going on in California. In California, in the Central Valley of California, we have an illness called Valley Fever, which is a fungus infection from coccidiomycosis. The endemic rate is about 3% of infection, although most people don't get seriously ill. It's one of those things, you get it, you cough for a few days, you're better. African Americans and Asian Pacific Islanders are particularly susceptible to the ill effects and deep effects of Valley Fever. We have lots of prisons in the Central Valley. In two counties in the Central Valley, 2/3 of the patients who have serious illness with Valley Fever are incarcerated, most of them at one single prison, Pleasant Valley State Prison. Has the Department of Corrections done anything to alter their policies of placement, keeping people with devitalized immune systems who have chronic hep C or have had cancer chemotherapy, blah, 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 anemias, out of Pleasant Valley? No. Are they going to build more prisons? Are they going to add to Pleasant Valley? Yes. They're going to build another big prison right on that site. And when asked, the corrections types say, well, we're hoping that there'll be a vaccine soon. Okay. So, yeah, there's been this complete disconnect historically, and John, pointed out how it happened in England, but it happened because they already had a National Health Service. I mean, wasn't that the key piece of that puzzle? So that's my long answer to your interesting question.
What a misnomer, Pleasant Valley. This gentleman here, could you speak really loudly, please? It's quite
loud.
So that's a question about how we begin to reduce the prison population back to sane levels, really. Yeah. And if Corey starts, and then we also get a perspective from John.
And I'll be brief, and there are perhaps others in the room who would like to assist in answering this question. I would say the first thing is we need kind of political courage. We need some people who are in the body politic who actually tell the truth. As I said, you know, the prosecution and detention system doesn't protect us. Now, you know, it's you can get elected by saying it does. You can get elected by, and you can cause someone to not be elected by pointing out that some released parolee under his, when he was governor, like Dukakis happened, if you remember that whole debacle, you know, went out and killed someone. And you can kind of sell yourself on the backs of people who are under the grip of the criminal prosecution and detention system. So I think we need some kind of a truth commission or something. We need people to talk about how it really is and help people understand that so that we can start dealing with reality. Because right now we're dealing with delusion. It's delusion. You know, all the people, I hear people say, I refuse to let my kid, walk to their soccer practice because they might get snatched on the street. You know, that is the most, it's a sad delusion. You know, if you're worried about your kids getting snatched on the street, look to your ex-husband. He's the guy who's going to do it. This anonymous snatch on the street that people are so afraid of is not, it is a delusion. I mean, I think we live in a world of delusion around crime and punishment in the U.S., and so the first thing, just to kind of normalize that, is going to take someone with political courage who's a little more coherent than Dennis Kucinich.
And more charismatic. If I could just try and add a couple of things into that. I mean, one of the critical issues that we struggle with in the UK, and I've not really spent enough time in the US. Well, the time I spend is usually on holiday, and I don't look at the news or read the newspapers when I go on holiday. But one of our big problems is our media, particularly our printed media, our newspapers. And we have, I don't know if this means anything to you at all, but we have a group of papers called the Red Top Newspapers. And the Red Top Newspapers are basically written for people with a reading and writing age of about 10 years old. And these are the papers that very simplistically sensationalize the way the world is, and these are the papers that tend to drive public opinion. Let me give you an example about this. About 3 years ago, our Lord Chief Justice made a comment about the fact that people who steal a mobile phone from someone using violence should expect to get a custodial sentence. And the newspaper headline in the Red Top newspapers read, "Mobile phone thieves to get prison sentence." And the following day, the rate of imprisonment for simple misdemeanors of stealing mobile phones, not stealing it by mugging you, but taking it out of your pocket or taking it off the table, these people started being imprisoned. And it took 4 months for the combined weight of the Ministry of Justice to slow the judiciary down. The judiciary were being driven by what they were reading in our Red Top newspapers. and people were being driven by the red top newspapers. Now, I don't know how we get a handle on the red top newspapers, but these are the guys who, for whatever reason, can fearsomely drive public opinion. And because they drive it so fearsomely, they can also drive political sense. And I think one of the keys to this is to try to find an alternative way. And I, this is probably very pie in the sky, but to try to find an alternative way of getting some of this truth that Corey's talked about actually debated. Now, I don't know where we do that for the people who carry that opinion, but it does seem to be that one of the inherent evils in our society is around a section of our media who tend to drive whatever they decide they want to drive just for the purpose of public entertainment. So I think we've got to try and get a hold of them. The other, perhaps easier concept to get our heads around, I think, is that we have to start dealing in more prevention work. A colleague here mentioned about health. I said in my presentation, we don't run a national health system, we run a national sickness system. We invest all our money in intervening when people have become ill. And there are a few people now working on trying to sow the seeds with perhaps a future government around how to start to move some of that money out of intervention and into prevention. I don't underestimate how difficult that will be to do, but it won't just be in the field of health. It'll need to be in the field of crime, it'll need to be in the field of poverty and so on. So that would be my thought for what it's worth.
Can I make a quick comment? If any of you have research funds and you're wondering how you could spend them, it would be really nice to try and do a simple comparative study between some of the countries within our project. Finland, at one time, had the worst imprisonment rates in Europe. They now have one of the best. And in the steps that they took, deliberate political decisions, deliberate policy changes, surely we could look at these. And incidentally, John, I'm told that the media played a very significant role in the way that it reported crime. So there you are, anybody, I don't know, maybe $20,000, $50,000. That's a good research project for somebody anxious to do a PhD.
A brief comment from me is that back in about 2001, we had some Russian generals come across to look at our system, and we had breakfast meeting, and they said, "We gave a lot of thought last night to the way your numbers keep increasing. What you've got to do is stop sentencing young men to these very short sentences. It's a complete waste of time." So our Russian colleagues might have a point there. Can we come to this gentleman here, please? So that's a real dilemma, isn't it? That people get sentenced to prison because that's where the services that can be easily accessed are. Can I invite you to say a little something on what you've seen across Europe on diversion or trying to avoid prison populations rising, Lawrence?
I think that kind of treatment, we don't call it mandatory treatment, we call it more like alternatives to imprisonment, and it's done many places now in Europe, and it's working very well. And for instance, because I think majority of prison population now are drug users, and they go in because of drug-related crime, and in many countries of Europe, they still go in just for using drugs. Especially in the eastern part of the new European Union member state, but in the eastern part of our region, they go in for just using drugs, and that is very bad for the prisoner and for the prisons, because the flow of drugs that will go into prisons, and a lot of people will start using drugs, and we have studies in Europe that tell us that 20-30% of drug users they state that they have the debut in a prison. Of drug use, I think the reason for that is that you put drug users into prison, and they should be treated. It's just a disease, and medically we call it a chronic disease, and has to be treated like a chronic disease.
Thanks, Lars. Sage, at the back there, you got a question? Okay, thanks, Sage, for raising issues around research. What I suggest is, I'll just mention the fact that back home in the United Kingdom, there's a prison health research network which is trying to create research-friendly prisons that will engage more readily in research. There's the problems of getting in and out of the institution, of getting the ethical approval and all the rest of it, and also the fact that prisons are busy places when they're overcrowded, and it's quite hard to arrange for prison research to take place. But the important thing is that extra dimension of the setting is properly researched to see what the issues are. First of all, could we come to what you know in Europe, and then perhaps get an American perspective on research as you know it?
I mentioned briefly in my presentation that we have a developed prison health database, and many of the indicators they can actually only be put in if you have some research, prevalent studies on risk behavior and so on. And so we urge that way member states to start researching in the prison setting. At WSO, we do some research ourselves, but in Europe, I see an increasing number of research going on in prisons, and it's not that difficult any longer to get permission to perform research in prisons. I think the ministries, Minister of Justice, are much more keen to allow that nowadays, and they want to improve the conditions, and that's the way they see how to do that, and also to get more funding for the prison settings. So I don't think it's the case in Europe that it's getting more difficult. It's the opposite, I think.
One thing to mention about research in U.S. jails and prisons is that the programs that I've seen that have been most interesting and effective have been when the jail or prison medical service has been independent of the custodial service. So they encourage research. In fact, there was that moment, that brilliant moment at Rikers Island, where they had this, I think Montefiore was in charge. Montefiore had the contract, and it's a teaching learning institution, and they had a full-on research program. and they came to APHA every year and presented great stuff, that groundbreaking material, very creative, very interesting. I think where you see the University of Connecticut had doing HIV services in a prison, and they did, you know, better research, and primarily because they're interested in their medical care and medical services rather than the kind of protectionism, the custodial attitudes that you see when the health and medical services are run by the custodians, by the administration of the custodians. So, but I would also say that I encourage everybody to do research in prisons and jails, because we want to get non-custodial people in there. That's all. Just get in there. Be a physical presence in there. Go there. Visit the prison. I want all of you to visit a prisoner. I want all of you to go inside. Do something. You know, break down those barriers that are, because it's so insular, and they feel so embattled, and they're right to, and they should be. And I really encourage the attempt to do so. Sometimes there are a lot of hurdles to go over, but it's worth it for the prisoners. And then in another session this morning, Dr. Stoller talked about kind of advocacy research, doing research with a particular something in mind. You know, knowing enough about the facilities to know that there are these wrongs, and now let's go in there and document them and clarify them, such that policy change and political pressure must occur as a result. And so that's one of the kinds of research that I think is most useful to the prisoners right now.
I just wanted to make one quick comment, and it really builds on what Corey was saying at the end, which is that, I think it's the more people we can get into prisons for whatever purpose, the less closed institutions they are. We don't have a big problem with people doing research, although it's tightly governed from an ethical point of view, because we get some pretty wacko ideas for things people want to research in prisons. But I just wanted to make one statement, which is, if you ask yourself the question, do we need to know more, or do we need to find better ways of using what we already know, it's the latter. We know enough. We've already today talked about all the things we know. We know they're facts. They're hard-edged, validated research outcomes, provable evidence. I don't want to say we don't need to do more research, but we've got bags of evidence. The real challenge for us all is, how the hell are we going to use that to change the way the world's working at the moment, because the world's gone haywire.
Thank you. That's Corey saying he wants to get you all to go to prison, and John wants you all to be in prison as well. That's good. One more question. I think we've got just time for one more, actually. So that's about the revolving door of people coming out, about the intergenerational cycle of people coming in and out of prison, and those countries that seem to be able to maintain family relationships better with better results. We've talked obviously about the politics of all of this, and what's possible in Scandinavia isn't possible in England, for example, for some of the reasons that John's been talking about. But Lars, would you like to talk about the more enlightened Scandinavian things that you know about coming from Copenhagen, and anything else that you've seen in terms of why we've got this sort of rather amazing span of different approaches?
I think it's a very difficult to give a European perspective here because it differs so much in Europe from country to country. For instance, Scandinavia, it's even if you get a high sentence, very often after a short while you get allowed to get out during weekends and so on, so you still be in contact with families. So that's the common rule. I recently, because I'm Danish citizen, but I haven't been visiting prisons before recently in Denmark, and I visited a high security prison, and prisoners only had to be in their cells between 10 o'clock and 7, 10 o'clock in the evening and 7 o'clock in the morning, and then they go to work in prison in different. They could choose different workplaces, or they could take training, or they could go to psychotherapy. Everything was like a job for them. And if they were sick one day, they had to go to the GP in prison and get a sick leave. They get payment, and they had a supermarket in prison. They bought their own food. They could went to back to small houses where they could cook, and they did that. So they still was, you know, they had to do something and be active. And they could get out very, after sentence, two-thirds of the sentence they will get out. And the high sentence there is maybe 8-10 years, so you never get this like you have here. So people are getting back to society very, very fast.
One of the exciting things about our WHO project is that we have 35 countries sitting around, and they can tell us the different ways they've approached very similar problems. I personally think we should make greater use of the experience. I mean, when you get people from Finland, Denmark, and so on, with the Azerbaijans and so on, the exchange of experiences in those circumstances can, I think, be very fruitful. I think the challenge to us in the project is that we pick up more of this rich material and make use of it to disseminate it.
I know I said it was the last question, but Bobby Cohen's just signaling to me he's got a very, very small point to make here. So, Bobby. Was eloquently put, and we'll leave those big issues hanging in the air. Just could you join me in thanking the mouse and the panel for joining in?